Welcome to Family Fortunes. I'm sorry, this is of course theatre voice, but the other title is the phrase that best describes, to one degree or another, all five dramas on offer in this week's bumper new writing package. We have Less Than Devoted Sisters and Beleaguered Parents, all peppering the plays. Mark Ravenhill leads the pack with not one but two plays. The Cut, starring Ian McKellen and Deborah Findlay on tour, playing Salford, then next week Bristol Old Vic, and finally Liverpool Playhouse, while his 2004 play, Citizenship, is at the National's Cottesloe Theatre. The latter is a 50-minute play joined by two others, Burn by Deborah Gearing and Citizenship by Enda Walsh. We'll be discussing all those later, but first it's time to welcome a modern-day rarity, a new play written not for the subsidised theatre, but for the West End. Smaller is not only a West End first for playwright Carmel Morgan, it's her theatrical debut. She's a TV writer, best known for her work on leading soaps, including Coronation Street. And she was commissioned to write a play for her leading lady, one Dawn French, who wanted a play she could perform with her friend, the singer Alison Moyet. Morgan rejigged a piece she was already writing as a two-hander, and the result opened at London's Lyric Theatre on the 4th of April in a production directed by Kathy Burke. Dawn French plays dependable Bernice, who teaches by day, but who has, for 25 years, spent the rest of her life at home caring for her widowed, wheelchair-bound mother Maureen, played by June Watson. Bernice's sister Kath, meanwhile, is forever absent, having skedaddled as fast as her legs would carry her into a minor career in musical theatre. Now holed up as one of the Henoritas, a bunch of entertainers in a cheap Spanish holiday resort, Kath sings songs which the playwright places between scenes of vexed family relations back home. The first of these songs includes the oft-repeated line, "Go home," and it's pretty damn clear from the outset that sooner or later Kath will take her own advice, stop making music, and start facing it by doing the prodigal daughter routine. With me to discuss this Kathy Come Home play, and all the others on the bill, are Michael Billington and Alistair McCauley. Now, Michael, a new play in the West End, it's not a dramatisation of a novel, it's the real deal. Do you greet this with pleasure?
Well, in principle I do, certainly, and it deals with an issue that I think faces most people at some stage in their lives. How do you cope with an aged, sick and dying parent? It so happens I've been through this experience very directly quite recently, and I recognise certain truths within this play. The exasperation that you feel for someone you love, the fact that you may be looking after them, but at the same time they become a burden and a nuisance. And also the way the mother in this play, who is, I think, the pivotal character, she is the real focus of the play, and brilliantly played by June Watson, the way the mother herself is both an intolerable moaner and whiner, and she's self-indulgent and all the rest of it. At the same time, she knows what a pain and a burden she is and how she's denying her daughter's life. I thought there were truths within this play, but that didn't make it a very exciting evening to watch, because I thought it just lacked momentum and variety of incident and character. I wanted more people on the stage, apart from anything else, other than these three characters.
Alistair, do you share Michael's feelings about the double-edged qualities?
I agree, absolutely. It won't just ring bells for anybody who's been in that family situation. It will clang them. It's not an offensive play. It's not an inept play, but it is slow and obvious and rather banal. You just think, fine, I've got that. Move on quickly, please. And then at the other end, extreme, 2 days after the premiere, I find myself seeing it again, done at 10 times the speed in Beckett's footfalls. Suddenly there is again this passive aggression and martyrdom going on between mother and daughter in a play that lasts less than half an hour, with a whole lot of extra meaning going on in between as well.
I mean, it's interesting that you immediately draw reference to another writer. I thought one of the problems with Carmel Morgan's play was that I began thinking of an awful lot of other plays, perhaps not directly about the caring situation, which I do think, as Michael says, is handled very impressively. There's a lot of detail in there. But I began to realise this is one of those recriminations after a funeral play. There was Simon Mendes' Da Costa's Losing Louis, which came in from Hampstead last year. There's Sheila Stevenson's play, The Memory of Water. This has been done many, many times. And when you get to the really big showdown at the end, or what should be the really big showdown, all I could think of was that Carol Churchill's Top Girls does The One That Cares and the one that Leaves an awful lot better. I found this increasingly disappointing.
I think you're right. When you get the second half and you get the sisters confronting each other, you're in such familiar territory that there's not a lot left to be said. There's always a sister who's left behind to look after Mum. There's always a sister who escapes the nest. And there's always that feeling of guilt and all the rest of it. Yes, we've been there many times. It was the first half that made this play interesting. And what I noticed was very strange about it was the grinding and repetitive nature of the mother's complaints began to get on the audience's nerves. I heard people saying in the interval, "For God's sake, I wish it stopped going on." I thought that was a kind of minor victory for the dramatist, because she'd brought home to an audience again the terrible tedium sometimes of looking after people who are genuinely ill, but who, because their lives are confined to a room, have an awful lot of energy. It's the people who go out in the day and work, as Dawn French's character does, and then come back in the evening. They're the ones who are tired all the time. The mother, who's at home and admittedly ailing, she's the one who's a bundle of energy in the evenings, and she can talk about all the television programs she's seen all day, what the neighbours are doing. And I thought that relationship, the mother-daughter relationship, the mutual dependability or dependence, etc., was very well done. Alistair's absolutely right. Of course, Beckett came to my mind. I was thinking of Rockabye, where a woman sits in a chair, rocks backwards and forwards, and in the space of, 15 minutes, perhaps, confronts death much more openly than this play does. Yes, it goes off the boil. It doesn't matter, I think, very much what we say. It has the feeling to me of an audience play, partly because it's got Dawn French in it, who seems can do no wrong for the British public. She's one of the people like Victoria Wood, who just has box office clout. And secondly, I think, as I said, people have been through this situation and will identify with it. And it's one thing we haven't mentioned, rather coyly we haven't mentioned. It's got a lot of very physical explicitness on stage, which I think people seem to rather relish these days. In other words, you actually do see Mum being put on the loo. There are jokes about piles, etc. It doesn't mince words, or indeed mince the physical difficulties of bringing up an old, of looking after an old woman.
No, that's a very nice point. I mean, you really see Dawn French go through the mechanics of lifting her mother. The boring bits, frankly, though, I think worse than anything, Act Two, are the stuff on the Costa del Neff with the sister. And I think Alison, is it Moyet, Moyette? I think is entirely undistinguished as a singer and worse as an actress.
I would put my hand up and say I got Alison Moyet albums. I got one. She is a good singer, but I don't think on this outing. I didn't see her Mama Morton in Chicago. Not a role that requires much acting. It's, you know, it's presentation in that production of Chicago. She can cut it. My real problem, though, that we haven't really talked about, is the production, which seems to me to be really both overblown and completely underdirected in a way that would surprise me from Kathy Burke, who's done very, very good work at places like The Tricycle and The Bush. I felt that the design completely screwed the play. Jonathan Fensom's revolve set slows the whole thing down, and that actually it completely didn't earn its interval. And actually, if this had been 90 minutes straight through at The Bush with a less starry cast, it might have worked rather better.
I think that's a fair observation. I thought the set, with not only this revolving stage, that's all right, but of course these rather bland curtains surrounding it, which looked a bit naff and ordinary. I agree with Alistair totally. I thought the Alison Moyet interludes with those awful lugubrious songs were lowering to the spirits. And what they looked like was a first-time author making concession to theatricality, as if to say, I've got to get away from naturalism. How do I do it? Oh, I'll cut away to the sister singing these songs in her cabaret. But the songs I thought were rather charmless, as indeed Ifrid was the performer. But I do bang on a bit about June Watson, who I think is one of those totally undervalued actresses. She's always there. She's been at the National Theatre, the Royal Shakespeare Company, Michael Bogdanov's English Shakespeare Company, remember, she played Mad Queen Margaret. Always reliable, but here I thought more than reliable. I thought she was creating a woman who was both monster, a total monster, and yet at the same time someone who says to her daughter at one point, I'm no picnic, am I? And my goodness, how many of us have heard relations do and say similar things to that, to acknowledge the misery they're causing others.
And on that note, let us move on. Smaller is playing at the Lyric Theatre on Shaftesbury Avenue. Joining me and my panel today is Heather Neal. She's joining us for the Mark Ravenhill double, plus the other two plays at the National, which is where we're going next. These move down a generation from the parenting business. Byrne, Chatroom and Citizenship are three plays as part of Susie Graham Adriani's National Theatre Connections series. Susie Graham Adriani works in the Education Department and each year commissions playwrights. There are 12 of them in most years. They're commissioned to come up with a one-act play to be performed by schools and youth groups up and down the land. Previous writers who worked on the scheme include Peter Gill, Bryony Lavery, Alan Akeborn, Patrick Marber, Sarah Daniels. In other words, the cream of British theatre writing. This is no pat on the back, little education programme with young people being asked to write for young people. This is about high quality. And one of the bonuses for the playwrights that take up this opportunity is that instead of their work standing or falling on one production, they have the luxury of seeing her or his play performed in umpteen productions as schools up and down the land do them. The best of them are then gathered together in regional showcases, and the best of those are taken to the National for a week-long series of performances. Nick Heitner was so taken with the idea that this year he then took the whole thing one stage further, picking three of the plays and putting them into the National Theatre repertoire proper. Anna Macmin was brought in to direct all three with professional casts and production teams, and the results are now showing in rep, with two of them at any given performance. All three represent an acute look at the perils of adolescence at a time when peer group pressure is at its most intense. In Burn, Deborah Gearing looks at an outsider versus the group. In Chatroom, Enda Walsh marries the potentially dangerous dynamic of internet chatroom relationships to the fragility of teenage emotions. And in Citizenship, Mark Ravenhill looks at the internal and external pressures of teenage sexuality. Heather, let's start with you. How much of this, you've written extensively in the past about connections. How much of these plays was new to you? Had you seen them in their other incarnations when they were being done by schools?
As it happened, I hadn't seen these three. I'd seen quite a number of them, but I had read them all and talked to their writers. I'd also been to the weekend that the National Theatre holds every year at Bath, which is a sort of workshopping weekend, which is a wonderful opportunity where all the amateur directors, I shouldn't call them that really, should I, all the teacher directors and youth theatre directors work with the playwrights who all go, and professional directors like Max Stafford Clark and Lindsay Posner. They're all very high quality people who do very good work with them. So I had got some background about it. I thought, actually, although I enjoyed reading Burn as much as any of them, I thought it worked least well on the stage and actually seemed like something that was better read when I saw it. It's very beautifully written and poetic, but as all the action happens in retrospect and you have various narrative voices, it doesn't work quite so well when it reaches the stage. Whereas Chatroom, which one wouldn't necessarily think would work on stage as it's about various chat rooms and is therefore static for most of the time, did seem to me to work very well. And because we had all the people in one location, we got an immediate sense of both the isolation of those who speak and meet in chat rooms, and the sort of pretense at intimacy. It was all there for us to see, and therefore the plot, which involves two of these young people goading a third to suicide, even more dangerous and horrific when they are apparently sitting close to each other, although they are miles apart. Citizenship works perhaps best as a play, and it's very, very funny. I did think in this production that maybe we were laughing at the young people a little bit more than would have happened in a production done with young people in it actually going through those agonies. But I did laugh a lot, I must say.
Is your evening beset by laughter, Alistair?
I love these three plays. I agree about the faults of Burn, but I kind of don't need to dwell on them. I nonetheless was just moved by the central dilemma there. Fabulous acting, by the way, in all three plays. I would send people to go to the Strippable just for the acting alone. But I had a very good time with Burn, despite, you know, I thought the production with Heroes there slightly too precious and the poetry overdone this, but not important. citizenship, as you say, is a hoot. Mark Ravenhill does his best work, I think, at this level. 2 years ago, I went to one of these Connections evenings, and his play Totally Over You, which was his adaptation of a Molière, was done. It's the best thing I've ever seen by him, and I think a kind of breakthrough for him into writing a more substantial work as drama than anything he'd done before. Of course, he's written much more famous plays, but he's actually getting a more sophisticated craftsman because of these plays, I think. But the great event, I think, is Chatham. The darkness at the heart of this and the cruel manipulations that go on with these two more composed characters. It's like something from the French 18th century. It's like Laclos or Marivaux playing with this poor man at the middle. And as I say, these performances just have your heart beating.
Michael, your overview of all three?
I didn't think much of Byrne, quite frankly. I thought it was precious, pseudo-poetic, rather than genuinely poetic, and I thought it became a wallow in adolescent anguish. And it, for me, it made the evening rather longer than it should have been. The other two plays were outstanding. Citizenship, Mark Ravenhill's play. Yes, Alistair's right, I think. Mark Ravenhill seems to write extraordinarily well for young people for these short commissions. And I thought this play, particularly the way it was played, Citizenship came as a welcome light relief. The other two plays were rather somber. Citizenship was very funny, about something very serious, adolescent anguish, sexual uncertainty, not knowing whether you're straight or gay at a certain age or which way your life is heading. Beautifully done. But I agree again with Alistair. I thought Chatroom was a remarkable play. And for those of us who are technophobes, it reinforced all our suspicions.
If you ever thought the internet was a terribly dangerous thing, do not go and see this play.
Well, seriously, I mean, what are chat rooms for? I mean, you may say they increase communication, but as this play proves, what they can do is increase people's sense of solitude and sense of aloneness. And there's a terrifying line when one of the manipulative characters says, "In these rooms, words are power." And obviously through the chat room you can exercise a sort of Machiavellian authority over unseen people. I thought it was a terrifying
thing. Without any responsibility, you never have to see the results.
Well, it's the physical divorce of actions and their consequences. Mm. You're not actually present and therefore in some way unimplicated. It's interesting that the writer, Enda Walsh, considers Byrne to be the best play of the lot, he told me. I didn't take him up on it. I don't think so. I think it was a genuine discussion about how much he really did like that. I also agree with everyone that I think that Byrne attempts a kind of dramatic poetry that it doesn't quite achieve. But I do think that it's relative degree of success, and particularly the success of the other two, is very largely to do with Anna Macmillan's direction. I mean, I think there's a very disparate group of actors here. Most of them are very young. Some are fresh out of drama school. Some do have an amount of performance behind them. Matt Smith, who's incredibly impressive in Chatroom and also in Citizenship, has been in On the Shore of the Wide World at the National and prior to that at the Royal Exchange. But I think the amount of detail that is brought to the fore in those performances and the balancing of relatively young actors is incredibly impressive. Although I find the physical production, Jonathan Fensom's design, seriously disappointing. I think if you're going to have an aesthetic, it's difficult to have an aesthetic for three entirely different plays, but to have your back wall mirroring the walls of the exterior of the theatre didn't seem to me to be lending very much to the proceedings at all.
No, and the result is that, and the rest of you won't agree with me here, I think, that the National Theatre is now the only place I am sending people to see new plays, because to me, this Triple Bill and Southwark Fair are the new plays to see. I'm not sending anybody to any other new plays in town.
No, it does feel like that, although these plays, both this and Southwark Fair got written about as if it were not quite, it was a failed serious play because it's funny in some quarters. I don't think it's been given its due. And these plays, I think, are too easily assumed to be about young people and for young people in a kind of dreadfully patronising way. And
they're certainly not patronising. I think the other thing that perhaps we should say is that this scheme gives writers some sort of liberation. It sets them free to do things they didn't think they could do or wanted to do. You've mentioned Mark Ravenhill, but I mean, Enda Walsh hasn't written like this before either, and Gregory Burns got one in this year, and he said he's very surprised to find himself writing a happy ending, and he's really enjoyed doing it.
You're quite right. So Patrick Marber a year ago did something himself.
Yes, what this is doing is drawing attention to the connections, shell connection seasons, which I still think is probably not enough covered critically, actually. I mean, I've been going for the last 2 or 3 years. It is, we all know this, one of the most exhilarating occasions at the National. Young people take it over and occupy. The Olivier Theatre, for example, it's wonderful to see people at school age taking over the Olivier and showing it can be used very imaginatively. Yeah.
And also, it's just great I think back to some of the drama work I did at school. And then I remember really vividly about 5 or 6 years ago, a school from Cheshire did a production of Bryony Lavery's More Light, which is one of the most thrilling things I have ever seen in a theatre, where a boys' school did a play that was entirely with female characters. It was kind of Japanese, highly stylized production. And at the end, all these women are immured in a tomb, and it cuts forward to 3,000 years later when the tomb is opened, and this light came down from the top of the Olivier stage, and an enormous ladder was brought in, like the one that they used in the Richard Eyre Guys and Dolls, and the tomb was opened up, and thousands of origami birds floated in, and it was an absolutely extraordinary image. And the thought that everybody in that auditorium was transfixed by the work of people, schoolboy actors, it was really, really exciting. It has nothing to do with, isn't that nice, and everything to do with really vital theatre work.
The only blot, I think, on the Shell Connection season, the original Shell Connection season, is they feel the need to preface it with some superfluous celebrity who comes in and cracks a few jokes. It's often some failed alternative comedian, or even a successful alternative comedian, which is even worse. And that always lends an air of patronage to the evening. The nice thing about seeing these three plays we've been to was that we didn't have that. We didn't have, I wouldn't name names, some flatulent TV celebrity coming in and introducing it.
You're right that it's a long evening. You can book to see just two of the plays.
Most performances are only two. The critics got one of the rare performances.
Given the choice, I would recommend, if you can, go to see all three, do, even though it is long and though Burn isn't the greatest thing in the middle. But certainly, well, we're all talking about Chatroom, which is extraordinary, but I would not want anybody to miss Citizenship with Lyne, where the school teacher says to the boy whose earlobe is bleeding, he says, "You're bleeding all over. What does a multicultural society mean to me?"
Very, very nice performance from Richard Dempsey as a teacher. It's a very... That's the Ravenhill play, I think, is fantastically assured as a piece of writing. He's writing the kind of stuff that a lot of dramatists never get to do, which is the other great thing about the scheme, is if you're writing for schools, you don't have to worry about how many actors are in your budget. You don't go, I think you better write a three-hander because it's going to go on at the Bush and we can't afford anymore. You can write for 20, 30, 40 people. And I do think Ravenhill's handling of enormous crowd scenes is very, very impressive.
Monsterists, get in here.
Yeah. And he asked to be part of the scheme. He thought it was so great. I must say, it's very nice to hear things that started out under the banner of education being treated like this. It's great for me, I would say.
I think it's led to a lot of mutual admiration between playwrights, curiously. I happened two, 3 years ago to bump into Patrick Marber somewhere, and he said, "You've got to go and see this Mark Ravenhill play for Connections." And I realised they're just all having so much fun watching each other's work.
The last thing we should say before moving on to the last play is that we're calling it Shell Connections. It is no longer Shell Connections, because in their infinite wisdom, Shell have decided that this is not something that they should be sponsoring. I think they wanted more brand recognition of their own product within the text and couldn't understand why they didn't get it. And if there's anybody listening that wants to sponsor quite the most imaginative theatre scheme going, they should get in touch with the National Theatre, because it ticks every conceivable box, it seems to me, if you were looking. It's attached to one of the most prestigious arts organisations in the country. It's nationwide. It's got youth. It's got education. It's a pretty impressive
thing. Shelling out for.
Thank you very much. And on that note, we will move on to the final play, another Mark Ravenhill. This one is a little more recognisable in the Ravenhill canon. It's a dystopic vision. A dystopic vision of the future in three scenes, all centering around Paul, played by Ian McKellen, as he tells the barefoot black character played by Jimmy Akinbola in the opening scene, "I'm authority, power, strength, the father." But he has a surprisingly genial tone, and under that we sense that other things are happening, and we realise that he's preparing him for the cut. We're never sure exactly what the cut is, but we realise gradually that it's a brutal, socially controlling, lobotomy-like procedure administered by the state to cut away history and wanting. In the second scene, we discover that Paul's job is a complete state secret that he withholds even from his family, most obviously his elegant wife Susan, played by Deborah Findlay. Not unlike the wife in Fahrenheit 451, she's mildly sedated and oblivious to the horrors of her husband's life. Or is she? By the end of the play, power has changed hands, and there's more than suggestion that the well-intentioned revolutionary change may not be incontrovertibly positive. What makes Vision of Ravenhill so unsettling is that his future is similar to the past and the present. Without ever being so crass as to draw direct parallels, his use of words and phrases like core values, inclusion, and performance targets is indicative of the fact that he's casting more than a sidelong glance at contemporary politics. Michael, how did you feel this measured up?
Well, Ravenhill's strength as a writer has always seemed to me his almost journalistic sense of what is going on around him and his ability to tap in to the culture and to record it. And, of course, that's what made Shopping and Effing so famous, and indeed some explicit Polaroids. I didn't like this play very much. I thought it was admirably performed. I didn't like the play very much because it is just too vague and cloudy and uncertain. You said, yes, dystopic, yes, set in some future, but where, when, how, why, what is the cut, what does it symbolise? And how one tries to define it, one comes down, if I may say so, to rather hesitant words. You said it's about removing a sense of history and wanting. Yes, but, you know, what kind of society is operating this? I suppose the point I'm trying to make is this. I think we live in a world that is filled with injustice and cruelty and barbarism and things that need correcting. And I think, in a sense, Ravenhill's taking the easy option here. He's painting a vision of some very gloomy future, but without telling us precisely what it is that the state is doing to people, what kind of state it is anyway, what kind of system McKellen character is working in. I thought it was too vague to be really disturbing.
From the sound of things, Michael wanted the play to be more detailed, more precise. Did that lack of precision worry you, Heather?
Yes, and I particularly agree with what you said about Ravenhill's strength being his observation of what's happening around him. And this is particularly true of language, and the language in this seems to be quite banal and dead and repetitive, and it's so different from the liveliness of his usual dialogue. But one is left sort of working out as if it were some sort of puzzle. And of course, you can come to your own answers, but whether they're his or not, I don't know, about obvious things like the difference between doing duty and living a good life and so on, and the tension between these two things causing the breakdown in Paul. The bit I enjoyed best, actually, was the middle scene. I thought that picture of a marriage where things are known and unknown, said and unsaid simultaneously was good.
How about you, Alistair?
I agree about the lack of precision, but I'm puzzled by it because it seems to me a problem in this play. This play feels to me the most repro thing that Ravenhill perhaps has done, an imitation of various other playwrights. It particularly reminds me of that play, and I can't remember the name of it, by Martin McDonagh, done for the National Theatre, which
was... The Cripple of Inishmore.
No. Much more... The Pillow Man. And to me, The Pillow Man did work that way. It wasn't, you didn't quite know where it was set and so forth. It wasn't precise, but I was absolutely in The Pillow Man and held, whereas I'm not here. It got, I think, stronger as it went on. The first scene, I think, is the most synthetic of the whole lot. And I think that Ian McKellen's performance also gets stronger. Wonderful acting with Deborah Finlay in the middle, but also McKellen does very remarkable things in the scene with his son in the final scene.
My feeling is actually the reverse feels, Alistair, in that I think although I think you're right about the performances developing, I felt that the play considerably weakens its own case with the last scene. In the first two scenes, one is uncertain. Michael sees that as a lack of precision. I saw it as metaphor. It worked for me on that level, in the way that Carol Churchill, a writer that Ravenhill admires above all others, a play like Far Away is completely unrooted and unspecific and resonant. And there was a resonance for me in the first two scenes. But the play closes itself down in the last scene. I don't want to give too much away, but in the last scene, it becomes clear that the audience is either working at the same speed or is indeed ahead of the characters. We know this is about a state that's gone to the bad, having intended to be revolutionary and good. The first two scenes, we're catching up with the characters. And what I found really impressive about the writing was the degree that Ravenhill is trusting subtext. This isn't a play that's easy to read, I don't imagine. And it's hard to watch because you are forcing yourself to work out what's going on and you're reading stuff, which is why I think the middle scene is so incredibly well played by Deborah Finlay and Ian McKellen. And you get, at the end, you get an almost Citizen Kane-like scene. There's a scene in Citizen Kane where you watch the years of the marriage going horribly, horribly wrong with a series of dining table scenes all edited together. Here you get 2 minutes, 3 minutes of stage absolute silence where they eat a meal and don't talk to one another. And it's absolutely filled, which is a measure not only of Grandage's direction and the playing of those actors, but the fact that they've generated so much from very, very spare text.
Yes, but I'd like to go back to a point Heather made about the lack of texture in the writing, and this seems to me fundamental, because one can invoke lots of other plays, Far Away by Carol Churchill, Pinter's Ashes to Ashes, which I could also argue lack social precision, and yet I find those plays theatrically powerful, because I think the language of those plays is concrete and precise. I mean, famously, in a play like Pinter's Ashes to Ashes, you don't quite know where you are, but the moment you have those images of children being torn from their mother's arms, of characters on railway stations being bundled into trains, it suggests something very specific and concrete. I thought the outer scenes of Mark Ravenhill's play, the first and third scenes, the crucial political scenes, were so imprecisely written as not to tell you what kind of world we're in. If the middle scene works, and it does for all of us, I think, it is because the language has taken on more precision and care, and the acting is phenomenal. McKellen has a forgotten talent. We always think of McKellen in heroic parts. I remember him when he began, and he was very good at playing what I would call civic parts. You know, he comes from a family of Bolton civil servants, and he knows that world, and he's got the gestures and the mannerisms of this man precisely. McKellen eats brilliantly on stage, doesn't he? At one point, he has a plate in front of him, and he scoops up the contents of this plate in one continuous gesture and shovels the fork into his mouth. Wonderfully observed acting. But I still think there's a political blandness about this play, a political vagueness, a political hesitancy about this play. I want to know much more clearly what kind of society this is, or whether this is indeed a comment on Britain today.
I don't want to overdo its force. I'm like you, I came out saying what was wrong with this play, but the day I saw it, I went on to see the new Arthur Miller at the Old Vic, and I was longing to see the cut off again by comparison.
And I do. I would, as the person here that seems to be more in favour of it than everybody else, I would say that I do think that for me, there's a side track. I think the one choice that I worried me about Grandage's production, which is quite exquisitely designed and lit by Paul Wills and lit by Paulie Constable, which makes the Donmar look like the biggest theatre space. It's fantastic use of height and depth. But he shows us the cut being performed, and I suspect that that's an error. It's not in the script. And I think that focuses one down into looking at what is actually going on. Whereas really, clearly, the fact that the play is so underwritten, it's throwing you off. You shouldn't be worrying about what the cut is. You should be looking at what happens to people that administer things by the state. When you see the cut happen, it makes you go, so how are they doing this and why are they doing this? Under what circumstances and under what politics have generated this and what is it about? And that lack of, that oddly, that trying to root it physically, I think maybe doing the play a disservice.
This play is an event, and I think anybody who goes to see it will see something of some substance, but I just wanted, after his work at the National for these kids, among other things, as well as his daffy but most imaginative, peculiar one-man show at the Royal Court and the Edinburgh Festival, I wanted Ravenhill to break through into something more original than this.
But you have to come back to the central argument. If, as you say, David, the state is here deliberately removing history from people's imagination and mentality, you have to ask why. And you have to, secondly, to ask, well, if we are losing our sense of perspective and history, is it to do with state, or is it to do with myriad other things? Is it much more to do with advertising? Is it much more to do with television? Is it much more to do with the culture in which we're brought up? Is it to do with education? Why would the state have a vested interest in removing people's historical memory? I thought he'd never begun to get near those questions within the play.
Well, I think we'll probably have to agree to disagree on that one. But I would like to thank Alistair Macaulay, Heather Neal and Michael Billington for joining me, and you for listening. Thank you.